believers sailing off to their deaths under the sway of his new world. There's Glafira Rosales, creating a family, a history, a world that hoodwinked the art community for 20 years. Every confidence artist you've met is in the exact same business, using our deep-rooted need for belief in all its guises to advance an agenda all their own. The screaming evangelist or the grandstanding religious leader or the cult spiritual guru is simply the most extreme incarnation. He doesn't just go after small beliefs, he attacks the core of existence. "We're really adamant we have free will," Stalvey said. "But so often that's simply not true. Everyone has a weakness. We want to connect to someone or something greater. I'm spiritually bent, and here's someone offering me a way to be a better person. The cult stuff just goes to a different level from your regular con." Sullivan died suddenly in 2013 from a recurrence of liver cancer that caught everyone who knew him off guard. Conspiracy theories naturally sprang up almost at once. Had he fallen victim to an angry cult out for revenge? In the months leading up to his death, he had been planning a memoir of sorts to be co-written with the journalist Joshua Jelly Shapiro. Josh and I met in the winter of 2015 in a dimly lit bar on a quiet block in New York's West Village to talk about David's work, his outlook, his take on beliefs and deception. "He would have loved to talk to you," Josh told me. "That's the exact way he looked at it. Cults are the ultimate con game. The crux of the belief doesn't matter," Sullivan thought. "It doesn't matter if it's Vishnu, Jesus, or a new way to get rich quick. It's immaterial to me," he had said. The techniques and basic psychology remained the same. They're being profoundly, subtly, but profoundly manipulated at their great expense, at the expense of their life in some cases. And the reason it happens, and often happens to the most intelligent of people, note, Sullivan would say, the typical cult recruit, young, smart, sophisticated, savvy, is that human nature is wired toward creating meaning out of meaninglessness, embracing belief over doubt. "There are certain essential things we all have in common," Sullivan said. "There's a deep desire for faith. There's a deep desire to feel there's someone up there who really cares about what's going on and intervenes in our life. There's a desire to have a coherent worldview. There's a rhyme and reason for everything we do, and all the terrible things that happen to people. People die, children get leukemia. There's some reason for it. And here's this guru who says, I know exactly the reason." It's the reason behind all cons, from the smallest to these, the deepest. It is our need to hold on to belief, to meaning, logic be damned, that continues to fuel the great cons of the world, even as their contours shift with the times. Before, you could pick cults out like sore thumbs, Sullivan joked. Back in the heyday of 60s spiritualism, you could reliably follow the scent of spiritual awakening to the nearest guru. But in the modern world, it has all become more insidious. They wear suits and ties, host corporate retreats, look increasingly like the more legitimate self-help movements of modern corporate America. Like Landmark, an organization Jelly Shapiro told me that Sully considered quite cult and con-like, predicated on the same techniques, many of them not very nice, that wear at your sense of self and slowly change the parameters of your world. They are all founded on meaning, community, what everyone wants. That's why Sullivan found cults to be a particularly enraging confidence game, more infuriating than most. It was a co-optation of a very legitimate quest for meaning. Everyone wants to believe. Everyone wants meaning. Everyone wants stories that make sense of incoherence. Everyone sees meaning in chaos, crafts narrative out of haphazardly floating geometric patterns. It's natural, and it's not only understandable, but often laudable. Shouldn't we want to search for truth and discern the meaning of reality? Spiritual cons exploit us at our most vulnerable, and because the process is so natural and insidious, it is particularly difficult to resist. You become a sucker almost in spite of yourself. In a sense, then, managing to survive the cult or spiritual con, the ultimate in confidence games, is the closest we can come to ever figuring out how to avoid falling for the lure of the con man more broadly. Sullivan and Stalvey, after all, managed to infiltrate cult after cult and came out on the other side. They were, in a sense, con artists in their own right, doing the con artists one better, deceiving them into accepting that they were genuine marks who had been expertly suckered in. Sullivan was largely reticent about his specific approach. Tricks of the trade, he called them. But there was one thing he stressed over and over. The key to resisting persuasion and manipulation was to have a strong, unshakable even, sense of self. Know who you are no matter what, and hold on to that no matter what. It isn't easy. It was years before Sullivan was able to find a suitable female infiltrator. Stalvey, he said, was an exception. It's very rare to find someone to put into a cult. You have to have a very strong sense of your own identity, he said. And it's not easy to do this. The psychological techniques that are now employed to coerce you are phenomenal. When we spoke, Stalvey elaborated on the approach her mentor had taught her. One of the most important things, she said, was to maintain objectivity, logic to counteract feeling. You know your emotions will be manipulated. They always are in any con, big or small. That's the whole point of the put-up and the play. And once you become emotional, your reasoning can easily become short-circuited. Always pay attention to the details, she told me. That is one way to ensure that you are staying rooted in the physical, the objective, rather than the psychological, the subjective. The details themselves may be harrowing. Stalvey observed everything from physical abuse to kids banging their heads on walls to exercises and extreme shaming. Through it all, you have to make sure you are observing as much as feeling. Most con games, of course, don't involve such extreme manipulation, but they all depend on the mechanism of emotion to a significant extent. A large part of resistance, of making sure you don't start getting pulled in, is to know yourself well enough to recognize and control your emotional reactions. What kinds of things provoke what kinds of responses in me? And can I see it happening early enough to resist it by staying grounded in details and logic? Stanford University psychologist Roderick Kramer believes that one of the ways we can inoculate ourselves against false persuasion is through self-knowledge, one of the elements that forms what Sullivan called your core self. Know what people you're likely to trust, what triggers are likely to catch you, whether positive or negative, and try to be aware enough of your own behavior that you won't get swept up in it. In short, hone your skills of observation and detail noting, as Stalvey puts it, when it comes not just to others, but to yourself. Another key element in Stalvey and Sullivan's arsenal, set limits. I'd decide before I went in what my limits were, the lines I wouldn't cross physically or emotionally, Stalvey said. She made sure that trusted others knew those limits and were ready to step in if she was getting close to the edge. Of course, cons in real time aren't as clear-cut. You never know you're in a con game until it's over, and even then, not always. But the principle holds. Always know the types of comfortable limits you have and the boundaries you won't cross. Think of how many cons work because they take you, in the emotional heat of the moment, beyond a comfortable boundary. Frank Norfleet borrowing money when he'd never done so before, for that second chance at making a fortune. William Franklin Miller's victims investing even more money to recoup their losses from his ill-timed absence. Sylvia Mitchell's psychic marks handing over cash, only to regret it moments later under the pressure of her steady gaze. But by the time the regret comes, it's too late. The moral is simple. Know yourself well enough and ask the questions ahead of time in any venture or interaction. How much am I willing to stake? How much am I willing to lose? How far am I willing to go? And then never let anyone tell you, just once more. Of course, the entire dynamic of limits is predicated on knowing not just when, but how to get out. If you have a limit but have no mechanism to enforce it, the limit becomes meaningless, a car with its brakes broken. Stalvey always knew exactly how she would exit the situation, whom she would call, or who would know to come get her after a certain time if she hadn't emerged on her own. When it comes to other potential cons or situations where your comfort level is uncomfortably close, the same thing holds true. To avoid getting duped, Kramer stresses, have an escape clause or a way of exiting any interaction with your dignity intact. We often are sucked up in cons because we don't quite know how to disengage. It feels like we're losing face, letting someone down. And by the time we realize that, no, we should have gotten out, it's too late. The final mode of attack, one that is in many ways fundamental, says Stalvey, is knowledge, pure and simple. Just knowing what you're going through can be immensely helpful, she says. It's like boot camp. If you know you're going through 15 hours of psychological hell, you can prepare yourself. Before going deep into a new cult, she would make sure to learn as much as she could about its history, purpose, and techniques early into her infiltration. That way, she wouldn't ever be caught completely off guard. Of course, her experience was unique in the sense of having been planned. You can't learn about a scam you don't realize is happening. But what you can do is learn about cons more broadly. The types, the approaches, the methods, the techniques. Seniors who are taught about the grandparent scam, for instance, become far less likely to fall for it. And then, with any luck, you will be able to pick out a con game's contours before you fall in prey to its approach. Nothing, of course, is foolproof, and constant resistance takes a deep toll. Stalvey is now transitioning to being a full-time photographer. After 3 years and one infiltration that lasted over 8 months, she had had enough. I couldn't take it. It's not the life I wanted to be living, she told me. And even Sullivan, the lifelong infiltrator, came close to calling it quits. Everyone has a breaking point. I'm trained. I've been through this a zillion times, he said. I use techniques to keep from being programmed. And even with all of that, he nearly broke. He remembered that afternoon like it was yesterday. The cold ground, the rustling leaves, the faint echo of voices through the door to the training room. And he, lying in the earth, on his belly, covered by bushes, whispering urgently into a dying cell phone. On the other line, the lawyer who'd hired him for his latest infiltration. A kind of triple type A attorney who knows exactly what he wants, Sullivan calls him. He doesn't brook failure. And what he most desperately wants to convey to this man is one single urgent message. He needs to get out. I can't take it anymore. I think they're going to kill me. My cover is blown, he pleads. He has just come off several days without sleep or food, a session of extreme shaming where he was forced to stand in a corner without food, water, or bathroom access and answer to the name anal cranial inversion. A ransacking of his hotel room and sabotaging of his car, dehydration and exhaustion, worse than any he can recall, and mixed with it all, the certainty that he is going to be killed, or at the least badly hurt, after his assigned partner somehow manages to escape from the program. His fear is justified. He was the one who'd orchestrated her flight. All he wants to do is make a run for it while he still can. The attorney doesn't hesitate. What do you mean your cover's blown? What are we paying you for? You get your ass back in there. Sullivan insists. You don't understand. I'm at the end of my limit. I don't think I can. The lawyer insists more. Listen to me. Sully, listen to me. You get back in there. You haven't even been reborn yet. At that exact moment, the cell phone dies. And Sully gets ready to re-enter the windowless room where he's certain his days as a cult infiltrator are doomed to a premature ending. I knew I was in serious trouble. But what he also knew, perhaps better than anyone there, cult leaders included, was precisely why these most powerful of confidence schemes are as powerful as they are. And he could manipulate belief along with the best of them. My fallback is starting my own cult, he would joke. He understood these men. He was really forceful, charismatic, a good storyteller, Jelly Shapiro recalled. He understood the power personality. And so, when Sully returned to the room, to the theme from 2001 A Space Odyssey, the leader's chosen soundtrack, he returned with the beginnings of a plan. The order of the day was as usual. A healthy dose of negative energy thrown at the outside world, today's theme, anger at parents, followed by a redemptive message from the leader. At the session, Sullivan went all out. He yelled, he punched, he cried. By the end, his hands were bruised and swollen. He'd eventually need to be hospitalized for injuries, his voice hoarse. And then it came time for the redemption. Atop the stage at the front of the room, the leader took the microphone. "No matter how low you were," he told the audience, "there was a way out. Through him, through this program, through its training. All you needed to do was take his hand and together walk forward into a new life." It was very moving, Sullivan remembered. Not to mention the story about the throat cancer survivor who would never sing again, and then, miracle of all miracles, was once more able to sing. It was then that Sullivan jumped out of his seat. "Yes, yes, I know what you mean, I feel it," he screamed. "Oh, sir, can I just try to express what's inside me?" The leader looked down benignly. "Sure, anal cranial inversion," he acquiesced. With that, Sullivan grabbed the microphone and, before anyone could stop him, jumped on the stage. With all his might, every life-loving fiber of his body, he began to sing, belt out, as he preferred to call it, a song that seemed to encapsulate the moment, the impossible dream. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, I built it right to the last. They were weeping, Sullivan remembered. The head embraced me with tears in his eyes, and we all sang together, louder and louder, all off key and screaming, and I was redeemed. I was suddenly solid. I graduated. I got to be reborn. I got my new name. It was nice not to be anal cranial inversion anymore. And he didn't just redeem himself. He surpassed redemption. At the end of the program, the leader and his helpers, the angels, the Gestapo, Sullivan silently called them, asked him to join them in a private room. And there they informed him that he had been chosen not only to graduate, but to graduate to the training for trainers. I was deemed worthy to come and brainwash the next crowd coming through. Sullivan was able to take the game of belief to the next level. He knew precisely how the game worked, and he mirrored the leader's own techniques back at him, amplified several times over. He knew the power of the story and how to tell it well. How could he not be a true believer when his words were coming right from the depths of his soul? David Sullivan was never a true believer. That term he reserved for those he was trying to help. But he was, in Jelly Shapiro's words, a true seeker. He was spiritual. He wanted truth. He had lived with the Sioux Indians and studied with their medicine men, practiced Buddhism, roamed the political communes of the 60s. He wanted always to explore the depths and possibilities that spirituality could offer. He was drawn to it, Jelly Shapiro explained. He wasn't a cynical, secular guy, and he took it personally when people used spirituality for perverse ends. He resented it. That, in a way, was why he would become enraged at the false promises of the spiritual con. He knew just how powerful a thing belief could be. Something so fundamental to our sense of the world should not be tampered with for personal gain. Meaninglessness is, well, meaningless. It's dispiriting, depressing, and discouraging, not to mention profoundly disorienting and disturbing. Nobody wants their reality to resemble Kafka. And in those moments when it does, when we can't make out what or why or how, we nevertheless try our best, as soon as we recover from shock, to explain it all once more and fit it into any sort of schema. Even Joseph K. can't stand the apparent meaninglessness of his arrest and trial. He knows he must have done something, and tries his best to impose a semblance of meaning on the things that seem to keep happening through no doing of his own. Before humans learned how to make tools, how to farm, how to write, Already they were telling one another stories. And not just any stories, stories with a deeper purpose. The man who caught the beast wasn't just strong. The signs were on his side. The spirit of the hunt was smiling at him. The rivers were plentiful not because of the weather or some natural cycle. It was because the spirit or ruler or god or king of the river was in a benevolent mood. In society after society, group after group, religious belief in one form or another has arisen spontaneously throughout history. Anything that cannot immediately be explained must be explained all the same. It cannot just be. And the explanation often lies in something bigger than oneself, a bigger force, an unexplainable one that can in turn explain everything else. The often expressed view of modern science is that God resides in the cracks. That is, as more and more of the world is explained through understandable phenomena, it ends up being not so divine after all. The cracks in knowledge, the remaining gaps that we have no explanation for, are where the force that needs no explanation resides. Its home may have shrunk, but it will always exist. As long as there is something to explain and no easy way to explain it, belief will rise up. It's little wonder that so many cons flourish in the world of religious experience, and indeed that religiosity is one of the few factors that consistently predicts susceptibility to fraud. It's a thin line between belief in one miracle and belief in another. The B.B. and C. Thomas Pattons of the world had their work cut out for them. Religion is the natural breeding ground of the confidence game. The threshold for belief has long been surpassed. Now you need only the right preacher to give it just the right revelatory meaning. When he died in 1887, Adam Lord Gifford left an unusual bequest. He wanted his legacy to be used to found a series of lectures throughout the universities of Scotland that would promote and diffuse the study of natural theology in the widest sense of the term, in other words, the knowledge of God. From the start, the lectures were considered a great honor, so when the news came that he had been selected, William James readily accepted. In 1901 and 1902, James gave one of the most famous tours in the Gifford Lectures' history. It was a draining experience. After the first series of talks, he succumbed to a nervous breakdown, postponing the second tour by close to a year, and trying unsuccessfully to cancel it altogether. The result, however, became the basis of one of the most important books of his career, The Varieties of Religious Experience, A Study in Human Nature. In its pages, James didn't just visit the origins of religion. Into the same family he placed phenomena that to the religious and scientific men of the day alike were absolutely unthinkable. The psychic, the superstitious, the mystical. To him, it was all of the same vein. James was not an atheist, not by a long shot. He was, like David Sullivan, a seeker and a believer. But he was also a man of science, and to him the parallel was clear. If you believed, you didn't just believe in religion. You believed in all mystical phenomena, if the facts were there to support it. You didn't just believe what was convenient. You believed where you were led by the evidence. If you were someone willing to embrace religion, you should also, by right, examine the rest of the unexaminable. People balked. Religion was pure. That was worthy belief. Psychics were garbage. True religion did not admit any of that. Despite James's stature, James Ward, the British philosopher and psychologist, who had earlier left the ministry for his overly liberal views of religious doctrine, and had given the Gifford lectures before James, refused to review Varieties flat out. It was, he said, tainted with psychical research. He was as open-minded as the next person, but James had crossed a line. To James, though, there was no line. Everybody knows, he wrote to Elizabeth Glendower Evans, one of his former students at Harvard who later assisted him in psychical research, that the real life of religion springs from what may be called the mystical stratum of human nature. That mystical stratum underpinned all belief. The question was, which beliefs were considered acceptable and which dismissed. That was, more often than not, a judgment call that could be legitimate or could well be exploited by the ethically dubious. Every man, James said in his final lecture, is entitled to, and most certainly has, his own over-beliefs, which were the most interesting and valuable things about him. The tendency toward over-belief was inevitable, and it was ubiquitous. That the God with whom, starting from the hither side of our own extra-marginal self, we come at its remoter margin into commerce should be the absolute world ruler, is of course a very considerable over-belief. Over-belief as it is, though, it is an article of almost everyone's religion, James wrote. Most of us pretend in some way to prop it upon our philosophy, but the philosophy itself is really propped upon this faith. Everything was a matter of faith. The extent of the faith was the question. I state the matter thus bluntly because the current of thought in academic circles runs against me, and I feel like a man who must set his back against an open door quickly if he does not wish to see it closed and locked, he continued. In spite of its being so shocking to the reigning intellectual tastes, I believe that a candid consideration of piecemeal supernaturalism and complete discussion of all its metaphysical bearings will show it to be the hypothesis by which the largest number of legitimate requirements are met. In other words, all of us believe, intrinsically and instinctively. We just differ on where we draw the line between legitimate and illegitimate. One man's confidence artist is another man's spiritual leader. And that isn't something to worry about. It is perfectly natural, and it is indeed to be desired. No fact in human nature is more characteristic than its willingness to live on a chance, James concluded. The existence of the chance makes the difference, as Edmund Gurney says, between a life of which the keynote is resignation and a life of which the keynote is hope. Nobody joins a cult, Sullivan repeated often and emphatically. People join something that will give them meaning. They join a group that's going to promote peace and freedom throughout the world, or that's going to save animals, or they're going to help orphans or something. But nobody joins a cult. Nobody embraces false beliefs. We embrace something we think is as true as it gets. Nobody sets out to be conned. We set out to become, in some way, better than we were before. Con artists, at their best and worst, give us meaning. We fall for them because it would make our lives better if the reality they proposed were indeed true. They give us a sense of purpose, of value, of direction. That, in the end, is the true power of belief. It gives us hope. If we are endlessly skeptical, endlessly miserly with our trust, endlessly unwilling to accept the possibilities of the world, we despair. To live a good life, we must, almost by definition, be open to belief of one form or another. And that is why the confidence game is both the oldest there is and the last one that will still be standing when all other professions have faded away. Ultimately, what a confidence artist sells is hope. Hope that you'll be happier, healthier, richer, loved, accepted, better looking, younger, smarter, a deeper, more fulfilled human being. Hope that the you that will emerge on the other side will be somehow superior to the you that came in.
This is Maria Konnikova. I hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2016 by Maria Konnikova. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.